It's 1904, and 32 men line up for an Olympic marathon. By the end of this race, one guy will have cheated by hitching a ride in a car. Another will be so pumped full of literal rat poison that he'll turn gray and hallucinate his way across the finish line. A Cuban mailman will stop mid-race to eat rotten apples and take a nap. And two African runners will be chased off the course by aggressive dogs. Oh, and about half the field will just collapse. Some will nearly die. This isn't fiction. This isn't a fever dream. This is the 1904 Olympic Marathon. And it was so catastrophically bad that newspapers literally called it a man-killing event. And people genuinely debated whether marathons should even be in the Olympics anymore. So buckle up, because we are about to dive into the most gloriously disastrous foot race ever conceived by mankind. And trust me, every crazy part of this story is actually documented. History is messy,
weird, wild, anything but boring.
We're rainy day rabbit holes,
exploring the unhinged side of history, politics, and culture.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole. Okay, so let's set the scene. It's 1904, and the Olympics are being held in St. Louis, Missouri. Now you're probably thinking, why St. Louis? Well,
yeah, Jody, why St. Louis?
It was supposed to be Chicago. This is only, by the way, the third Olympics held. The first one was in 1896, the second in 1900, and so 1904. We're only doing this for the third time. It was supposed to be in Chicago, but St. Louis was holding the World's Fair that year. It was actually called the Louisiana Purchase Exposition, and it was all at the same time. And so Missouri said, either you'll hold the Olympics here or we'll hold our own, and everybody will already be here for the World Fair. So they moved it. The 1904 Olympics were nothing like Olympics of today, not even close. These Olympics were essentially a sideshow for the World Fair that particular year, and they were spread over 4.5 months.
So it's not the main event.
No.
Basically.
Yeah, it's just not organized the same way. The medal system was different. There was silver was the top medal.
Oh, okay.
And they only gave one, actually, and eventually gave bronze as second for a while, but you actually didn't get your medal there. It got mailed to you at some point months or years later. It was just not the deal that it is today.
When you win, they're just kind of like, good job. Bye.
Yeah. Bye. Have a
good... Nice job.
Sounds like there were crowds, but it went from July to November in Missouri.
Wow.
And most spectators that showed up had no idea they were even watching the Olympics. They thought they were just watching some sporting event randomly, and that was it. So it was just not quite the Olympics we know of today.
They were like at the World's Fair and like, what's going on over there? Yeah. Let's go check it out. Yeah. Sort of situation. They yep. just end up showing up at the Olympics by accident.
And there'd be some sporting event or something going on, and they'd watch and have no idea that it was the Olympics.
Sitting there eating their peanuts or whatever.
So the international participation was not so much as well. There were of 651 athletes who competed, 580 were American.
Oh, okay.
So that didn't leave much for the competition.
It was kind of like, so you're world champions of American football.
Yeah. So we did win most medals.
Yeah.
So there was 10 to 12 countries in total that did participate, but most of them were immigrants here in America already. So a lot of people were not traveling over to America. It was difficult to travel in 1904, yeah. First of all. And then there was the Russian-Japanese War, and Europe was a mess. So a lot of countries just were not participating.
So there wasn't these big delegations from different countries like there is today.
No.
Maybe a onesie twosie here and then people that were
already
here.
I will talk about one that comes from, you'll hear.
Okay.
He's my favorite.
Please tell me it's Ireland.
No. So the whole thing was just poorly organized and American dominated, basically considered the worst Olympics ever held. Oh. And the marathon is the crown jewel of the worst Olympics ever held.
Well, no offense, but a marathon is kind of boring.
Can you imagine watching it? Like, I used to watch my kids, they ran cross country, and I'm like, I'm here to cheer you on as you leave the starting line and return.
Yeah, exactly. And then the rest of it, like, you just hanging out. So, it's not like, you know, they didn't have things televised where you could follow your favorite runners.
Not. Yeah.
It was just, you're like, well, I guess maybe you get in a car and you go to another point or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there are viewing points for marathons now.
Okay. I have no idea. I thought I was going to run a half a marathon at one point in my life, and at 9 miles, my feet said no and gave me plantar fasciitis.
Oh, gosh. And that takes forever.
Yeah. And so I gave up running long distances.
Yeah, I never saw the point. I'm running for 3 minutes and I'm like, is this over yet?
Yeah, you have to run enough to get to that point where you get like that, like the runner's high, basically. Yeah. Where you're
I
like,
keep
I'm
hearing
free
about that.
And your body's just kind of doing its thing and you don't have to think about it. But that takes, it basically takes to get to about 6 miles, I think, is when finally get that. And it's just, yeah, I haven't run more than 3 miles in years.
Yeah.
And every time I run, I pay for it.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, it's not actually really good for your body or your joints when you're...
No, my knees and my feet, my ankles,
yeah,
they all hurt. Plus, there's something that happens as you get older. And as you're running, you can feel your butt cheeks bouncing up and
up and down.
More. And any like loose fat on your belly, you can feel that.
You got to wear really tight leggings.
You do. But even if you do, they're still like, my butt cheeks are just flapping in the wind.
Oh my God.
And rubbing together. The chafing is terrible.
Well, that never happens to me because I just don't run.
Yes. I have a solution for this, Shay. Don't run.
That's my solution. All right, where were we? Okay, so let's talk about how the marathon even became an Olympic event. The marathon was introduced at the very first modern Olympics in Athens in 1896, inspired by the legend of Pheidippides, the Greek messenger who supposedly ran from Marathon to Athens to announce the victory over the Persians, then promptly died.
Right.
So he ran all that way. And I'm like thinking, just to announce the victory. It's not like you're announcing someone's coming and you got to prepare.
Right.
Like, why did you do that?
And then you grow.
You could have taken breaks.
I know. Also, were there just no horses available?
Right. This is just, why did you do that?
Like 26 miles is fairly easy for a horse.
Right. Right. There was better ways.
Yeah, there were better ways to do this.
To announce the victory. And so that was the inspiration for this sporting event. Now, here's an interesting tidbit. In 1904, the marathon wasn't the standard 26.2 miles we know of it today. That distance wasn't standardized until 1921. The 1904 marathon was approximately 24.85 miles.
Okay.
About 40 kilometers. But it was still brutal. I mean, it was only like, what, a mile and 1.15 miles short?
Yeah.
So it's not, it was still pretty darn close. So it's still brutal, just slightly shorter. And this route went through the streets and hills of St. Louis. And let me tell you, this route was brutal. So the actual race conditions are important because this is part of the poorly planned and actively trying to kill people. Part of why this is the worst Olympics ever.
Actively trying to kill.
Yes.
They're like, let's not do this ever again. Let's see how many people we can kill.
Right. They don't want
it. They won't let us do it again. It was a bad idea before it started.
So the race was held on August 30th.
Oh no. Hot and
3:03 p.m.
Oh my God. The hottest part of the day.
Yes,
give me a break.
3 p.m. It was in August in St. Louis, Missouri. The temperature was over 90 degrees Fahrenheit and some say it hit 95. The humidity was oppressive.
Yeah.
I've been in the South in the summer. It's hard to walk down the street.
Yeah, it's like you're swimming in the air.
Yes, exactly.
It's so thick. Yeah, it's hard to breathe.
So I guess the organizers didn't see this as a problem and said, let's go. And it gets worse because the course was mostly dirt roads that had been absolutely torn up by automobiles throughout the summer.
Oh, so they're all rutted.
They're all rutted. So that's hard to run on.
Yeah.
And all the runners were being escorted by cars. Their trainers were in cars just driving along next to them and just in front of them. And so dust was everywhere.
Dust. There's nothing limiting emissions at that point. So it's just these cars are belching fumes.
Fumes,
too.
Yes. Fumes. And then there was also horses and bicycles. So there was just
a lot
of dust created and was creating the choking dust storm, and it actually coated their lungs and throats.
Oh, man. And then combine that with the humidity, and it's like mud that you're trying to breathe. Yep.
But at least there's water stations, right?
Oh, no. Oh, no. Did they forget water stations?
They didn't forget. This is where
like, here's a puddle.
This is where you meet villain number one. James E. Sullivan, the chief organizer of the Olympic Games and director of the Amateur Athletic Union. Sullivan had this absolutely brilliant theory that he made up himself.
Oh boy.
That drinking water during a marathon was actually bad for athletes.
Like slow you down?
Yeah. So he believed in purposeful dehydration. That's a quote because that was the title, how he titled it. Purposeful dehydration.
Was he a friend of Linda Hazard's?
Right?
He's like, you take the starvation side, I'll take the dehydration side. We can kill these people so fast.
It was a training technique he used. Not for himself, of course, for people he was training. So how many water stations did Sullivan provide for the 24.85 mile race in 90 degree heat?
Two.
You got it.
Wow.
Nailed it. Choking on dust and fumes? Two. Two water stations. One at around 6 miles and another at around 12 miles and nothing for the final 12 miles. And for context, marathons today have one at every single mile.
Yeah. So like, we don't want our participants to drop dead.
Right. Well, that's because of these people who have how they sacrificed. They owe it to the Olympic marathon of 1904 for their frequent water stations.
They're like, if you fall down because you're dying of dehydration, you just need to rub more dirt in it and get up. You pussy.
That's the other thing. They now have medical personnel big because of this marathon.
Because you could be going into a coma and go into the hospital. You might need some help. You can die from this.
Yes. Jeez. So this was actually an experiment that Sullivan was conducting. He had this theory, so he decided to conduct a test at this marathon.
On these unwitting participants.
Yeah, yeah, it was just Sullivan literally turned this race into a dehydration experiment using Olympic athletes as his guinea pigs.
Nice.
32 men started this race, only 14 finished, 18 dropped out, and several nearly died. Let's meet the survivors.
Wow, I thought you were going to say several died.
No one died. Oh, yeah. Wow. I just spoiled the ending. Just kidding. No one died. So let's meet the survivors they called medalists. But first, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to tell you about a man who cheated so brazenly that he almost got away with it, and another man who was literally poisoned by his own trainers in the name of victory. All right, welcome back. Okay, so we've got an Olympic marathon running through what is essentially a dust-filled sauna with cars driving next to them and almost no water. What else could possibly go wrong?
I'm sure a lot.
Everything. Our first character is Frederick Lors, a bricklayer from New York. Now, Fred trained for his marathon by running at night after work because he was a working class guy with a job.
Yeah.
The race starts and Fred's doing okay for the first 9 miles. Then around mile nine, he gets severe cramps. His legs are done. He's cooked. So what does he do? Drop out of the race? Does he walk it off? No, Fred Lors flags down a passing car and gets in. This is the Olympics, people. This man rode in a car for 11 miles.
No.
Just cruising along, watching the other runners suffer.
Is he like, you can go kind of slow. It's fine.
He's probably enjoying the breeze.
Right.
The car broke down at mile 20, so about 4.85 miles from the end.
And I have a feeling cars breaking down was common. Yeah, in 1904. So. They're still fairly new.
And Fred, feeling now refreshed from his little break, decided to jog the last 5 miles into the stadium. And yet, here's another wild moment. He jogged into the Olympic Stadium first, and the crowd went insane. They thought he'd won. He was about to be crowned the Olympic champion. Alice Roosevelt, President Theodore Roosevelt's daughter, was literally about to place the ribbon around his neck as the first place winner, where he'd get his silver medal later. And Fred was just going along with it, smiling, waving up at the crowd, soaking up the applause.
This is awesome.
But just in time, plot twist, some of the officials that had gone along on the course arrived and they were like, wait a minute, we saw that guy in a car. So the truth came out. So Fred claimed that he was just joking and never intended to accept the medal.
Right.
Sure, Fred. Uh-huh. But The Amateur Athletic Union actually banned him for life for that stunt.
But, yeah.
But like all meaningful lifelong bans, the ban was lifted a year later. And in 1905, Fred Lors won the Boston Marathon legitimately. He didn't get in a car.
Did somebody watch him really, really yeah. closely?
They're like, I bet that was better organized.
Yeah.
So he could actually run, but maybe under better conditions. Next up, let's talk about the actual first place winner of this nightmare race, Thomas Hicks, a British-born brass worker from Massachusetts. So he's one that was here as an immigrant racing as British.
Okay.
And not American, but he actually was living in America at the time.
Okay.
Thomas was struggling. By mile 20, he was in serious trouble, and he was dehydrated, exhausted, and ready to quit. His trainers, Charles Lucas and Hugh McGrath, were like, we can't let him quit. We need to help him. And by help him, they gave him a mixture of strychnine sulfate and raw egg whites.
Why?
Yes.
Why strychnine?
Believe it or not, his trainers were not actually trying to murder him. This was a performance-enhancing drug in the early 1900s. So,
yes. Enhance you right into the grave.
Yes.
Good grief. That's rat poison.
Yes, it is. In small doses, it was thought to actually increase your performance. Victorian-era athletes and doctors believed it had a stimulant property, and it was put in tonics and medicines.
I mean, we're talking about the same era where... like doctors were like, yeah, smoking's great for your lungs. It makes them healthy. And people were taking baths in radium water and drinking radium water. Yeah. And yeah. So,
yeah. So at low doses, we're talking about 1 to 6 milligrams, strychnine can act as a stimulant. At around 50 milligrams, it will kill you. So there's a lot of wiggle room in there.
Yeah, there is. It's interesting what comes and goes, right?
Right.
Is there something that you would think of now that's like similar or like in recent history where people were like, yeah, do this. It's really good for you. And later on, people realize like, no, this is killing you.
Can I think of something right now?
I mean, I can't think of anything that's dangerous. I'm just thinking about stupid crap like beef tallow where people are like, put it on your skin instead of sunscreen.
Oh, ow. And what?
Yes. Have you not heard this?
No, not as sunscreen. As moisturizer, I've not heard of it. Sunscreen.
People online are like, you can use beef tallow instead of sunscreen.
No.
It's so dumb.
I feel like that's the opposite effect.
So I go downstairs today, right before I came over here, and I just put my sunscreen on. So I was shiny. And my dad's like, what's all over your face? What? He's like, it's all shiny. It's like, yeah, it's my sunscreen. He's like, oh, I thought maybe you put beef tallow on it. And I'm what?
Why does he know about this? That's hilarious.
Because he reads the Epoch Times. These are the same quack right-wing weirdos that asked me one day. He's like, have you ever heard about grounding? And I was like, no, dad, stop. It's all this weird, like maha weirdo crap.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, no, dad. And I'm, when he asks me about these things, I say, it's absolute bullshit, dad. Excuse me. Bull beep, dad. And anyways, but as far as I know, beef tallow won't kill you unless you use it as sunscreen for your whole life and you get skin cancer.
Well, yeah.
But that's not the beef tallow killing
you.
That's you.
That's lack of sunscreen.
Sun and you, but yeah.
Well, I know they used to use x-ray for fun. People just put their feet under there and yeah.
Yeah.
That didn't turn out well.
I know. I did the research for Roy Olmsted, mm-hmm. his friend Al Hubbard that had an x-ray machine in their basement. There was one article where he was talking to somebody. He's like, I've learned that you can actually make your bones pliable by putting them in the x-ray machine. I was like, A, I want to know how that works. And B, that doesn't sound good.
Oh, no. Yeah, no, you're just dissolving your fingers is what you're doing.
That sounds real bad.
Okay, was he saying it like, I want my fingers pliable?
Yeah, it was supposed to be some sort of like being able to like straighten bones that were warped or something. I don't know. It was bizarre. I don't know what that's about. Okay, yeah. So they gave this poor guy strychnine to help him over the finish line.
So he gets his first dose of strychnine and egg whites at about mile 20. And his trainers also gave him some brandy to wash it down with.
That'll make it go faster.
Because sure, why not maximize toxicity and dehydration?
Yes. You know, I run faster when I'm drunk.
Well, right, at least I think I do.
Right.
Or you care less about how bad it hurts. Thomas keeps running, sort of. He's barely moving.
Oh, poor guy.
Around mile 23, he's in even worse shape. So his trainers give him another dose of strychnine, egg whites, and brandy. And at this point, Thomas Hicks is essentially a zombie. His skin has turned gray. He's hallucinating. And his trainers are literally holding him up and walking alongside him, keeping him upright.
Oh, my God. This poor guy.
Witnesses said he looked like he was, quote, running mechanically like a well-oiled piece of machinery that had nearly run down, unquote.
Oh, man.
And when he finally crossed the finish line, he collapsed immediately. He'd lost 8 pounds during the race.
Wow.
His body temperature was dangerously high, and he couldn't stand or speak coherently. It took over an hour for officials to declare him the winner because they had to make sure he actually survived.
Oh,
you couldn't be
my God.
Dead
but wait,
and
he
win.
Won? Wait a minute.
He won.
You could be dead and win.
They had to wait an hour to declare him the winner.
I think, too, if he had died, that would, and they were like, nope, sorry, you can't be the winner. That
yeah,
also
right?
would be really terrible.
Right?
Like, he literally gave his life for this and you take it away from him.
Rude. So his trainers had to convince everyone that, yes, he did survive and would survive. And yes, he also technically finished the race on his feet. So he technically passed the finish line. So that took an hour to discuss.
My goodness, poor guy.
Get this guy. Yeah. Okay, now we need to talk about my personal favorite character, the story of Felix Caravajal de Soto, a Cuban mailman who is the embodiment of chaotic energy. Felix decided he wanted to compete in the Olympics, so he raised money by running laps around a plaza in Havana, just running in circles, and people threw money at him.
Like, literally.
Yeah, that's how he raised the money. And he raised enough for a boat ticket to New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
But then, because Felix is Felix, he lost all of that money gambling in New Orleans.
No.
So he had to hitchhike and beg his way from New Orleans to St. Louis. He arrived at the Olympic Stadium on the day of the race wearing long pants, long sleeve shirt, and no shoes. That's all he had on him.
No shoes.
And street shoes. I'm sorry.
Street shoes. Oh, okay.
Street shoes. And that was his attire. One of the athletes took pity on him and cut his pants for him, so then they became shorts. But he still had his street shoes that he'd hitchhiked all those miles in. So I'm sure they were
probably
not
just,
in
like,
good condition.
Leather-soled, flat. No insole, nothing.
And a long sleeve shirt.
Oh, my God. I was going to ask, what was the running attire at this time? Did you see pictures?
They had, like, tank tops and the shorts that, well, there's more characters in the story. So the ones who look like they actually belong or trained, like you would see
like
more
like
today,
yeah.
Like the athletes, they had on, like, these tank tops with numbers and stuff. But everyone else had, like, what they came in.
Yeah, whatever they could, they could drum up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll hear
Were they like short shorts?
I don't think so. I'm trying to remember from the picture. They weren't like, they didn't obviously stick in my brain as super short.
Okay. We're going
to
have to.
I think they were tight though.
Okay.
They
we're going to have to include some pictures. We'll drum up some pictures. Because I'm just not sure what to think, like the visual to have. Is this like.
Oh, what they look
Are these like the super short running shorts that I'm thinking
of? Not quite like that.
Or are they like the. You've seen the boxing diapers that men wore in like the late 1800s, early 1900s. It basically looked
A
diaper.
A diaper. Yes. No, I did not see anything like that. That would have stuck in my head.
Okay.
I don't really recall what they were wearing in those.
Or like short pants, you know, like the ones that come right below the knee.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, maybe they were that long, actually, now that I think about it.
We'll look at it. We'll find a picture.
It didn't stick with me.
Okay, so this guy.
So the race starts, and Felix is just being Felix. He's vibing. He's chatting it up with all the spectators in broken English, just chit chatting on his way, jogging casually.
He's the life of the party.
He's waving at people. And at mile 15 or so, he gets hungry, and lucky for him, he spots an apple orchard. Felix leaves the race course, wanders into the orchard, and asks the folks working there if he could have some apples. They say no. So he steals two and takes off running.
They're like, catch me. I'm a marathon runner.
He eats the apples. But unfortunately, and maybe this is why they said no, the apples were rotten, and he ends up with a terrible stomach ache and cramps.
No.
Does he drop out? No. He just takes a nap.
Oh,
on the side of the road and waits for the cramps to pass.
Oh, my God.
And then he gets up and keeps running.
Oh, my goodness. This guy.
This man socialized with bystanders, stopped for rotten apples, took a nap in the middle of an Olympic marathon, and still finished fourth.
What?
Fourth. Felix is hilarious to me, but he treated the Olympics marathon like a casual jog in the neighborhood.
He came all the way from Havana for this. Yes.
It's so funny to me. But he honestly, to me, probably had the right idea. Everybody else was like dying and he was just chilling and having a great time. And he finished.
That'd be like if you and I went to the big podcast festival in London. Like, we spent all this money to do it. We took all this time off to get there. And all we did was go into the food court and eat hot dogs.
Yes.
And then because the hot dogs would give us a stomachache, we spent the rest of it in the bathroom.
Yeah. It's just crazy. Time of his life. All right, we need to take another break. But when we return, I have just a couple more disasters to talk about, as well as the aftermath. All right, we're back, and we've got a few more runners to talk about because this disaster has a deep bench of chaos.
I mean, it already has been pretty chaotic. Oh my gosh.
So our second place runner is Albert Corey, a French immigrant who was living in Chicago again.
Okay.
From another country.
He's representing France.
Yep. Well,
no.
We don't know. Well, Albert finished second in this race, right behind strychnine-fueled Thomas Hicks. His win is still not clear. There was a dispute about his nationality. Was he representing France or the United States? And the records are messy, and it was never cleared up. He won second, but they don't know how to award it because was he running for the U.S. or for France?
He's like, whichever one gets me on top.
Yeah, he did not care. And so... And in third place was Arthur Newton, but he thought he'd finished first. He finished the race in relatively good health compared to everyone else. And when he entered the stadium, he saw Lors already there, but he'd already seen him in a car, so he knew he'd been disqualified. And he saw Hicks carried across the stadium after his collapse. So while they were tending to him to see if he was going to live and win right. first place. And so he just assumed he was first because neither of those guys qualified to win. So he, in his mind, had been the leader of the final stretch because the people ahead of him were either in cars or being carried off, and none of them were running in his book. He never conceded first place because, he said, I never saw anyone pass me. He must have completely missed Albert Corey because
right,
he was also like... was there. So till the day he dies, he says he got first place because he never saw, and his reasoning is, I never saw anybody pass me, so clearly I won.
Okay.
Nothing else makes sense. Then we have William Garcia, a runner from California who nearly died during this race. William collapsed on the course and was found lying on the road, barely conscious. He had been rushed to the hospital with internal injuries, including a torn stomach lining from all the dust he had inhaled.
Oh,
the dust had
gosh.
Mixed with his stomach acid and basically started tearing up his insides.
Oh my gosh, that's terrible.
He survived, but barely.
Wow.
Now let's talk about Len Tao and Jen Mashiani, two Sawana men from South Africa who were the first Black African Olympians in history.
Wow.
But this part of the story gets really dark because Len and Jan weren't in St. Louis as honored athletes. They were part of a deeply racist Boer War spectacle exhibit at the World's Fair, essentially a human zoo where African people were put on display for white American audiences.
Ugh, gross.
Horrifying.
Gross.
Despite being treated as exhibits rather than athletes, both men were experienced runners. They had been dispatch runners during the Boer War, so they knew how to cover distance.
Yeah.
That's where the British were coming into South Africa and colonizing it. So that's the Boer War. Jan Mashiani was literally chased off the course by dogs during the race. Just aggressive dogs from out of nowhere come running him.
Racist dogs.
Yes, because it actually happened to both of them. There was no security at the time. And Jan took 12th place, even after being chased off the course. Len finished 9th place and probably would have been higher, but he also was chased by the dogs. Both men ran this entire nightmare race while dealing with racism, being treated as curiosities rather than competitors, and attacked by animals. People along the course were yelling out racist comments.
Oh,
to
I'm
them
sure.
As they were
I
running.
Wouldn't be surprised if people were throwing rocks and
so the fact that they finished
rotten apples at them.
Yeah, that's how they were treated for sure. The fact that they even finished is remarkable.
Yeah,
and But the fact that they're not celebrated in Olympic history is a travesty. They're not included in much. And when you look at the photos, I do recall their photos because one of them had like on shoes that were basically the soles were all they were held on by straps. They weren't supposed to be straps. I mean, it was just basically tied on soles. And the other one didn't have shoes on at all. When I was trying to see if they ran that way, people actually mentioned it in the research that they weren't sure. It was never recorded what how they actually ran, so no one could tell if they actually ran that way, but that's the only photo of them.
Well, I mean, to play devil's advocate there, there's a lot of different cultures that do a lot of running barefoot.
Yeah.
And there's a whole barefoot, like us modern white people have decided that barefoot running is better.
Keith,
and there's a lot of people that do it.
Loves his barefoot shoes.
And yeah, and then there's the barefoot shoes because, you know, we live in modern times and there's poop on the street.
We have a great hiking story where we hiked Little Mount Si as a family and all the way up. He's like, yeah, you all suck wearing those boots because I wear my barefoot shoes. I'm having a great time.
Oh,
and all
boy.
The way. And then the way down, let's just say he had no toenails. All you heard was swear words and yelping all the way down. I thought I was going to have to give him a piggyback ride. Not so smart now, are you?
That sounds about right.
All right. And last of the runners is Frank Pierce, a member of the Seneca Nation and the first Native American to compete in the Olympics. Frank was a talented runner, but he didn't finish the race. He collapsed from exhaustion and had to drop out. Given the conditions, that's not surprising.
Yeah.
What is notable is that Frank was competing at a time when Native Americans were facing forced assimilation policies and widespread discrimination. His participation was significant, even if he didn't finish the race.
Yeah, for sure.
Now the aftermath. So the race ends and the reactions are appropriate. People are horrified.
This really sucked for a lot of people.
Yes. Newspapers called it the man-killing event.
Oh, yeah.
Medical professionals were appalled. The public was shocked. People genuinely started asking, should we even have marathons as an Olympic event? James Sullivan, the genius who thought dehydration was a good training technique, quickly backtracked on his theories. Turns out, when you nearly kill a bunch of athletes by denying them water, you look bad.
Yeah.
The 1904 Olympic marathon led to major changes in how marathons are conducted today. Future races had more water stations, better medical support, and stricter regulations about course conditions. And the idea of purposeful dehydration was thrown in the trash where it belonged. And despite being an absolute catastrophe in 1904, the marathon stayed an Olympic event. So in the end, Thomas Hicks, the strychnine field winner, never competed again. Frederick Lors, the car riding cheater, went on to have a legitimate running career and became a respected athlete.
Felix, it was just that one time.
Felix, our favorite Cuban, returned to Cuba and continued being a mailman.
Aww. But now with a great story.
Yeah. That was some fantastic story. And the 1904 Olympics as a whole, they were remembered as the worst games ever held. A cautionary tale about what happens when you prioritize spectacle over athlete safety and when you treat the Olympics as a sideshow. And when you let a pre-incarnated RFK with a weird dehydration theory make all the decisions. And that's the story of the 1904 Olympic marathon, the most gloriously disastrous foot race in history.
Wow. That was bonkers. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't stop laughing when I was reading it over and over, getting ready for the episode.
That was amazing. Thank you.
It was a nice, lighthearted episode, I felt like.
So I have...
I mean, as disastrous as it is.
I've come across it as a topic, like, to be suggested as an episode that we should do.
Mm-hmm.
The 1904 Olympics was a scheisse show. Can I say scheisse on the radio?
Mm-hmm.
It's just in the original German.
Oh, yeah. Well, just say that's English and then it doesn't. Well, if you say it's German, and now it's a swear word.
Right. Yeah, but I never actually knew the whole story. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard the story of the first woman to run the Boston Marathon?
Yes.
That one where she had to like pretend to be a man.
She had to pretend to be a man. And when they figured it out, people were trying to attack her.
Yeah.
Other men, though, protected her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was a really
They gave
good
up
story
their
too.
Own race.
Yeah.
Other runners to protect her, which was amazing.
Yeah. Craziness. Mm-hmm. All those crazy people running.
Yeah, there was no women in the 1904 marathon.
No, absolutely not.
I was going to look. I forgot to look to see if they were in any event in the Olympics in 1904.
I would assume not.
That's what I was thinking.
Did they have an Olympic baby carriage pushing event?
Baking.
Olympic baking.
Apple pie.
Yes, there you go. They could participate in the pie throwing.
Yes.
By baking the pies.
Yeah. Not throwing.
No, just baking the pies.
And then cleaning up the mess.
Exactly. Thanks, ladies. We're going to go off and have some scotch and cigars.
Thank goodness you're here.
Well, thank you. That was awesome.
That was a fun one.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. And we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Rainy Day Rabbit Holes, if you forgot already.
You can find more stories like this, plus photos and sources at rainydayrabbitholes.com. Our site is built by Letha Davis at easybreezy.com. That's E-A-S-Y-B-R-Z-Y.
Easy breezy. It's breezy.
Our social media wizard is Logan Hine at Redemption Industries. And you can join our Patreon for bonus episodes and ad-free listening. The link's right there on our website. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a proud member of MSW Media. And this episode was produced and edited by me, Shay.
Master editor.
I wouldn't go that far, but I'm not bad. Not bad.
Not bad editor.
So thanks for listening. Stay curious and
see you down the rabbit hole.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.